Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. It's August 10th, 2009, and this is episode 203. I can't believe it's been exactly a year since I did my last Q&A episode. I recently received a great question from a listener, so I figured I'd do Q&A podcast number 10 today to share one of my responses here. And I actually have another of a few questions that have come in recently. I'm going to do a few more of these in the coming weeks, but today I'm going to cover the response that I gave for this one question. I am also going to touch on manual mode in my response. Although I've done a whole podcast on this, I think it was way back in episode 10, so 190 episodes ago, and I've touched on the on why I use manual for most of my shooting, but there are certain times when you really need it, and I've touched on this a number of times. But the subject comes up a lot, and you know, in the forum and in various places. So I figured I'd go into detail on why I use manual mode as well today, to see if we can clear some of that up. Remember that if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, you know, I'll always try to answer them as I can. You can drop me a line at questions@martinbaileyphotography.com, or you can use the contact form on the website. You can also drop me a line via Twitter, Flickr, Facebook, wherever. The links to all of these social networks that are out there now are all on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com now. So if you want to hook up with me on one of those or all of those, you can do. I'll do my best to answer any questions from my own experience, but if I can't answer, I'll also try to find someone to interview that can answer the questions better than I can. So, you know, really anything that you want to ask, just ask away and I'll do what I can. Before we get into the main topic today, I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors, WebSpy. WebSpy are internet monitoring, analysis and reporting specialists who can help to improve the performance of your workforce or your students without unnecessarily restricting their access to the internet. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to our landing page, which is webspy.com/MBP, and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on any of WebSpy's packages. So the question that I'm going to answer today is from Eric Vogt from the States, and I'll read out Eric's mail first and then we'll get into my answers. So Eric said, "Thanks for all of your teaching and all of the time you sacrifice for our hobby. I was at the beach in Oregon this past weekend where the skies were overcast. I was shooting the many pelicans there, but so many photos looked like the one attached. How would you approach shooting into an overcast sky? Would you set the exposure compensation to overexpose a full stop or so? I was able to slowly get very close to these shorebirds, but I was disappointed with lighting in the photos. Was it just a foul day for good photos of these birds? I've heard so many times that overcast skies can give great light, but is that just for portraits?" So thanks very much for the great question, Eric. There's actually two parts of the question here, which we'll split up as I merge my manual exposure explanations into the middle here. But basically, the response is a bit long and there's a lot to cover. But I'm sure that Eric is not the only person that has trouble with these sort of conditions. And as I say, the manual shooting thing has come up a lot of times. So I think it's worth putting a bit of time into this one. So let's just take a look first at Eric's shot to see what we could have done. I've uploaded Eric's shot to the blog post, which is where I've also got the transcript for this podcast at blog.martinbaileyphotography.com. So do take a look if you want to follow along. The image is also in the Enhanced podcast, so you'll see it in iTunes or on your iPod as well. The first thing that I want to say is that the pelican itself is very sharp, so congratulations on your technique, Eric. I also like how you've not got the pelican dead center, which is great. For sure, an overcast sky is not the most ideal for shots of birds in flight. We don't always have the luxury of choosing the shooting conditions though, so I'll explain what I'd bear in mind here if I was shooting in these conditions as well. On the exposure, you're right. Had you used exposure compensation, this would have improved the shot greatly. I'd say that you could have gone to around plus one and a third, or you know, one and a half stops even, depending on how your camera's set up. And also it depends on the on the metering mode. That we'll get into it a little bit later, but evaluative metering is better these days and may well have handled this better. But you know, what I did was I basically took your image into Lightroom, Adobe Photoshop Lightroom, the full name, and I played around with it a little bit. Bearing in mind that I'm using the JPEG, what I did was I actually increased the exposure with the slider to 1.33 stops of exposure. And what that did, it showed me roughly, you know, it's a pretty good sort of simulation of what the exposure on the camera would have done. And it shows me that you could have gone that much and you wouldn't have blown out the sky, and you'd have seen a lot more detail in the pelican there. And, you know, you can also see that the sky is almost white now, which is what you probably saw, Eric, when you were shooting the image, and not quite as grey as the original that we are looking at now. So I'm going to switch the images over now so that we can see the image that I messed around with a little bit in Lightroom. The sky in the original shot is almost a perfect grey card. It's almost exactly what the camera wants to do to every image you shoot, which is turn it into an 18% grey. Overcast skies can be great, and I personally prefer an overcast sky for many subjects, including flowers and landscapes in many situations. For this sort of bird photography, though, it does pose a challenge to get nice flight shots. My suggestion, if you are to shoot in conditions like this, is to just get as close as possible, fill in the frame with the bird and reduce the amount of sky around it. Notice also that in my version, I cropped the line of trees out as well. And this is more of a cosmetic thing, but you know, I don't think they add anything to the shot. And although I realized that this was just an example of the, you know, the exposure, I just removed that. So just letting you know really why I did that. The basic idea, though, is just to get as close as you can and edit out anything that's not needed, you know, for the image. Just keep it as simple as possible. It's often the best recipe. I know that there are limitations to how close you can get, either physically or with your longest lens. I see that Eric used a 200mm focal length, and I found out in some follow-up communication that Eric was using the 70-200mm f4 IS lens, which is a wonderful piece of glass. And Eric also tells me that although he had the 1.4 extender, which is what Canon calls a teleconverter, by the way, he didn't use it because he wanted to get some shots of some friend's children on the beach. This is a worthy reason, of course, to leave the extender off, but quite often we have to make a decision on which subject to go for. If getting a good shot of the pelican is important to you, then you could drop the extender on for a while, at least until you get your shot, and then take it back off again and go on shooting the kids. Trying to do more than one thing in photography can often end up with us not getting your shot or any shot at all. Realistically, though, for bird photography, even with something as big as a pelican, you need something a bit longer. Even with 280mm, which is what the 70-200mm f4 lens would reach with the 1.4 extender fitted. And even, I noticed that Eric's using the Canon Rebel XT, which has a 1.6 crop factor. So Eric was actually shooting at 320mm anyway. And that would become 450mm with a 1.4 extender, which is pretty good. And, you know, it would have really given a lot more sort of, you know, bang for the buck if Eric had put the extender on there. And it probably would have made for a nicely framed image of the pelican, and the grey overcast sky would have become much less noticeable. Ideally, though, especially if you're going to shoot smaller birds, pelicans are pretty big, but if you're going to sort of get into bird photography and shoot smaller birds, it would be nice to get something a little longer. I realise that that budget is always going to be a something that we have to bear in mind, I really enjoyed the 100 to 400 millimeter lens from Canon for a number of years, especially when I was just starting out with wildlife and bird photography. The 100 to 400 is a little bit soft, but you can't beat it for versatility. You could also consider something like the 150 to 500 millimeter from Sigma, which is a great lens for birding. But it's a little bit dark. It starts at f5.0 and then goes to f6.3, the aperture, as you zoom towards the 500mm end. And I haven't actually got any personal experience with this lens, and I usually like to talk from my own experience. So I can't recommend this lens as such, but I've heard that it's a relatively good lens. Still, it's not an incredibly expensive lens for the reach, probably worth thinking about, but I know that budget is always going to come into the equation here. Again, in follow-up communication with Eric, I also heard that Eric was thinking about the 300mm f4 with the teleconverter, or the 400mm f5.6 prime lens from Canon, which shows that Eric is definitely a discerning photographer when it comes to sharpness. My advice here is that if you can handle the fact that you'll miss some shots because of the inability to zoom, then for sure these prime lenses will give you sharper images. I myself use the 300mm f2.8 sometimes with and sometimes without the 1.4x extender, and I'm getting incredibly sharp bird shots, even when handheld and even with the extender. But I do miss shots sometimes. I'll clip the wingtips off, or even I can't get the bird into the frame as they come closer towards me sometimes. I do, of course, use a second body with something like the 70-200 f2.8L lens. And, that's basically, when I'm shooting big birds like the red crown cranes, they can sometimes fly overhead, requiring a much shorter length to fit in the frame. I'm happy with my decisions at the moment, and I'm enjoying the nice sharp images. But like I say, I do sometimes miss the versatility of the 100 to 400, by using prime lenses and extenders and things as the main lenses that I'm using at the moment. My point here is that for serious bird photography, you really can't avoid getting a longer lens. I also use the 600mm f4L lens, and I put the 1.4x extender on that when I need that extra reach. So, I have been considering the Sigma 300 to 800mm lens too. I'm hearing a lot of good things about that lens, and the versatility along with that reach is something that's really not to be sniffed at. I think, it's got a constant aperture of f5.6, which isn't great at 300, but, as you get out into the 500 and 600, 700, 800 millimeters, then it's not a bad aperture for, a lens of this focal length. We're talking $7,000 or $8,000 or so dollars there, though, depending on where you buy the lens. And I realize that most people aren't going to pay this amount for what is, essentially a hobby for a lot of people. I'm certainly not saying that Eric needs to run out and buy an $8,000 lens either, but had he managed to fill the frame with the Pelican, then not only would the camera's meter have gotten a better exposure reading, because the darker subject would be filling the frame more, it would have also enabled Eric to get rid of that sky and, like I said earlier, really make it much more unnoticeable. Again, if something doesn't add to the shot, just try to get rid of it. That's one of the major bits of advice here. I should note, though, that with regards to composition, even when cropping tightly, I would still leave a little room for the to the right to give the impression that the pelican has some space to fly into. Rules are made to be broken, of course, but in general, you want to give your subject some room to move into. Putting it right up against the side that it's moving towards can give a sense of drama, but more often than not, it's just going to look like bad composition. With cameras having more pixels each year, you can also, of course, consider cropping the image in post-processing. But you don't want to throw away too many pixels if you might want to print the image pretty large at some point. If you only want to use the image on the web or view it on a computer screen, though, that would be fine. Anyway, let's get back to the exposure discussion. As although until now I've been replying to Eric's question about exposure compensation, another thing that comes up very often is shooting in manual mode. In Eric's situation, shooting up at a plain grey sky, exposure compensation would have been fine, unless the pelican flew across a much brighter or, a much darker background, of course. If that's the case, although this can be a very daunting aspect, a very daunting part of photography initially, I usually recommend using the camera's manual mode. Whenever the subject is moving from a background that is sometimes brighter and then other times much darker than the subject, it really helps to not have to think about the background at all. And the only way to do this is to use manual mode. If you stay in one of the, shutter priority or aperture priority, then your camera's meter will be fooled and you'll definitely have, the bird's exposure itself or the subject, no matter what you're shooting, will run off and you'll either underexpose them or overexpose them. And that's not what you want. You want to have the exposure set for your main subject. It takes a lot of getting your head around if you haven't tried this for yourself. But if you keep in mind that your subject's color and luminosity will not change unless the lighting conditions do, it really doesn't matter how bright or dark the background is. If you know that you have set your camera's exposure to your main subject correctly, that is. I've spoken about this many times before, but the subject comes up quite often, as I say, in the forums and, various places. So I want to take a look at a few example shots of my own to illustrate what I'm talking about. And the first one that I want to look at is image number 2115. Now, this image would probably have only required around plus one third or so of a stop exposure compensation because the main, although the main subject is predominantly white, the top half of the background is very dark. So it would have balanced itself out, only requiring a little bit of compensation. I can't tell you exactly how much compensation I used because I shot this in manual mode and that doesn't leave a record of the exposure compensation, because it's not used. Imagine, though, that if after I'd shot this first image, I turned and saw the crane that we see in image number 2126 preening himself with a totally white background. Using evaluative metering, which now does tend to sort of recognize a snow scene better than it used to, I'd probably have needed to add it around 1 1/3 stops of exposure compensation to tell the camera that this scene is predominantly white and that I don't need it to be darkened down at all. Without this compensation, the camera would have tried to make it an 18% grey, which we all know is not the colour of snow. I should note that it used to be common to use or to need up to 2 stops of exposure compensation for bright snow, but the newer meters, they really do a great job. If you're in evaluative mode, it seems to recognise snow scenes much better, like I say. So it's, the old sort of adages are a little bit sort of outdated now. Normally around 1 stop to 1 1/3 is about where you'll find yourself these days. This scene lasted, the one with the bird preening lasted a little while. And I could probably have, thought to change the exposure compensation if I was using aperture priority. Imagine, though, if as I was buried deep into my viewfinder and I was shooting that preening crane, what if I heard a honking coming from my right and I looked up and saw a pair of cranes like the ones we see in image number 2107? They'd just come into sight and were perfectly in line like this. I then have to think, okay, so now I'm going from a perfectly white scene to a shot with a very dark background. I'm probably going to have to go from plus one third of a stop to minus one stop, maybe, or I'll overexpose the two birds here. And I start to turn the dial, and while I'm looking at the carrot on the meter and the scale in the viewfinder, and then by the time I've done the calculation, I mean you can get used to this and remember the number of clicks, obviously, but by the time I've done all of this calculation and made the change, the birds have landed. It only takes a few seconds to make those changes, but it's enough to miss the shot. I was able to get this shot literally in the conditions that I just spoke about, because I was in manual mode and my exposure was already set for optimal exposure for the cranes. It didn't matter how dark the background was because I had my exposure set for the cranes. It doesn't matter where they are, that's the point. Note that, these actual three shots that I just used are not, that it's not the real scenario. They were all shot in the same couple of days. But, the first two were shot at the same exposure of aperture of f5.6 at 1/640th of a second at ISO 100. The light had changed, though, for the last shot, and I was actually shooting at 1/2000th of a second at f4.5. But I'm just trying to make a point, that I do remember looking up, seeing these shots, these cranes that we looked at in the last shot. They were there. I'd got a split second. I didn't have time to mess around with that exposure compensation. They lined up. I got the shot, and then we moved on. That was it. So, there just isn't time when the birds are going from white backgrounds to dark backgrounds like this to really mess around with exposure compensation. Even if you're really quick with the flicking through, you remember one click per third of an exposure of a stop of exposure. I'm sure people that do this a lot get used to it, but in my experience, I personally cannot get fast enough at that, and it's so easy to work in manual mode that I just don't see the point, to be honest. Let's talk a little about setting the exposure in the first place now. Whether starting from scratch or with a hint from a priority mode, you'll probably want to set your aperture initially based on the artistic effect that you're looking for with the depth of field. For bird photography, that's usually close to wide open for the lens, though you might want to close the aperture down a little bit for larger birds, especially if they're not so far away, like Eric's pelican. Note that Eric closed down to or stopped down to f5.6, and that's probably about right, though Eric could probably have gotten away with f4 as well at this range and with that focal length. Once you have decided on your aperture, then you can just, you can go in and adjust the shutter speed to something fast enough to avoid camera shake. And Eric photographed the pelican at 1/1000th of a second, which will avoid camera shake, showing again that Eric is indeed a discerning photographer. If we think, though, that he needed to increase the exposure by around 1 1/3 of a stop, he would have needed to use a shutter speed of 1/320th of a second with an aperture, with the aperture that he was using, which, like I say, was f5.6. For a sharp image of a bird in flight, 1/320th of a second might have been a little bit slow. Although, the pelicans don't flap their wings that fast. They tend to soar more than flap. Ideally, you're going to want to be at least around a 500th of a second for birds in flight, though. But, really to a degree, the faster, the better. If you want to show movement in the wings, of course, you can go much slower. And I've done that myself many times. But, that does reduce the success rate of your shots, and it would require a little bit more sort of explanation to do the subject justice here today. As you get close to what you think your exposure should be, though, while looking at the carrot on the exposure gauge in the viewfinder, say you're looking into a snow scene, you're going to be trying to get it 1 1/3 above zero, that is. You should also then, maybe shoot off a test shot and check your histogram. If you have live view, you can do that, without actually shooting off a test. But I find that, with digital, most of the time, you're going to want to expose for the highlights. And that means that the right side of the histogram graph will be close to the right side of the histogram box itself, but not clipping. And clipping means that the histogram is touching the right shoulder of the histogram box. It's okay to have a little bit, you know, if you know that it's in a part of the image that you don't care about, or maybe for specular highlights. But if you severely overexpose any important areas, then you definitely will lose detail there, and there's no way to get it back, even if you shoot in RAW. There are times when you will totally blow out a part of the scene, and there are times when you'll expose for the shadows. If that's, you know, the most important thing for you at the time, then that's fine. You know, I covered this in more detail in episode 81, though, and, you know, I'm not going to go into too much detail on that today, but as a general rule, you just want to remember to shoot for the highlights. Opposite to our previous examples, and more in line with Eric's question about the relatively dark pelican, if you are shooting a dark bird against a bright background, then you need to be careful not to let the background become too bright. If you overexpose the background too much, the bright areas can start to bleed into the bird or your main subject if it's not a bird, making the edges soft and even reduce contrast in the subject itself. Ideally, you're going to want to make sure that the histogram is close to the right shoulder but not touching it, and be able to see on the LCD that your main subject is well exposed. Unless the shadows contain detail that you really need to show, then don't worry too much about the left side of the histogram. Whenever possible, I like to use the RGB histogram as opposed to the standard black and white histogram. This is because you can actually blow out parts of one or two of the channels. You know, you've got the red, the green, and the blue channel. You can blow out one of those or even two. And it doesn't always indicate on the black and white histogram because it's only representing an average of all of the light values. If you set your aperture, you know, once you've got that all set, and then you set your shutter speed to, you know, to the one that, or you know, you're trying to set the shutter speed to freeze your object, but you find that the, you know, with all of your looking at the exposure and the histogram and everything, if you find that your shutter speed is too slow, then the next thing to think about, of course, is to raise the ISO. Eric shot his pelican shot at ISO 100, so, you know, really, if you, you know, to really remove the chance of blurring the bird after reducing the shutter speed to 1/320th of a second, if necessary, he could have used ISO 200 at f5.6, and that would have given Eric a shutter speed of 640th of a second, which may well have been you know, much better to avoid any subject movement during the exposure. Remember that the longer the lens, the more you have to think about camera shake, because longer focal lengths magnify the camera movement. The point here is that keeping the ISO in mind as your third method to change exposure is very important and can be the difference between getting the shot and not. I should say that I don't want people to think that manual mode is just sort of plain sailing either, especially on days with patchy cloud, when it can be difficult to keep up with the constant changing of the light. I am forever checking my exposure. You'll need to keep your eye on the LCD and the histogram and make sure that the subject is nicely exposed there. And if the light changes, you know, you'll notice that. And if you start to blow out areas, then you need to, you know, you need to remember to update your camera settings. And, you know, remember as well that there is that indicator on the LCD for, you know, to warn you of overexposure. If you see parts of the LCD, the image on the LCD flashing, then that means that they're overexposed. The exposure warning is often turned on by default, but if it isn't, look for exposure warning in your camera's manual and turn that on. It can be very helpful. As you shoot, you can often locate a reference object that you check your exposure on while waiting for the action to start. This might be a mid-tone rock or something like that. You know, walls, anything that you have around that's a nice mid-tone. You know, what you can do is sort of get your focus on your subject correct and see how that sort of compares to another object that you can use as a reference. If it's the same, that's great. If not, just remember the difference. My trick for doing these checks when I'm shooting in the snow is to point the camera down and totally fill the frame with the snow, and then just adjust the exposure so that I'm around 1 1/3 of a stop above zero. Remember that even in manual mode, you'll still see the exposure indicators in the viewfinder, so you're not alone. And also remember that meters these days are better than they used to be. So in general, you can forget that old two stops for snow advice if you're using evaluative metering. It's around 1 1/3 of a stop now. Just make sure that the carrot is where you need it to be, and then wait for the action to start again. So after all that, let's quickly back up to the second part of Eric's question. Yes, overcast skies are nice for portraits because the sky acts as a large softbox, but when your subject is flying and the light is coming from above, the only way that will actually help is if there's something to reflect light back into the bird. And that's, you know, like with the field of snow in the images that I used in my examples, then it's fine. Even with a dull sky and you've got plenty of light bouncing back into the bird, you'll get great exposure. In general, though, for a bird flying in the sky on an overcast day, without a reflective surface below it, if the contrast between the bird and the sky is simply too great, the only remaining option that I'm aware of is to use something like a better beamer flash attachment, which would enable you to bounce some light, some flash into the bottom of the bird from a distance. In Eric's case, though, I don't think that the contrast was that great. So, you know, although the grey sky was never going to be that exciting, it would not have blown out with 1 1/3 stop of extra exposure or by using manual mode and exposing for the bird. Note that I haven't gotten into the aspect of spot metering on your camera today, because not all cameras have spot metering. And to be honest, if you follow the steps that I mentioned today and set your exposure, you know, the way I've said, then you shouldn't need spot metering. Finally, I also suggest shooting in RAW, especially in conditions where exposure is challenging. Not only does RAW give you the ability to easily change things like white balance in post-processing, it gives you a much wider dynamic range, allowing you to save more detail in the highlights and also areas that are very deep shadows. You can bring out detail very nicely from shadows. So even if you do ignore them when shooting, if you do need to bring a little bit out, you can do that much better if you're shooting in RAW. JPEG will throw away much of this detail before it even writes the image to your memory card, so it's a bit of a waste. So anyway, that was a very long answer to a fundamentally one and a bit questions. Granted, I tagged on all of the manual mode stuff myself because it does come up so often. I hope that you have found this episode useful, though. I can assure you, most people that start out on my workshops thinking that they don't need manual mode usually become converts by the end of the first day shooting. In that kind of environment, it's far from photographic snobbery, which is what some people call those that shoot in manual mode. It's more like photographic survival and taking control to get the shots that you might not be able to get otherwise. If you are never in a situation where you need manual mode, then don't worry about this. Beware, though. I've heard a lot of people say that they don't need manual mode, when the truth is that they really just don't understand why they need manual mode. Wow, that was a long one, just to answer basically one question. Thanks very much for the question, though, Eric. Great one. And thanks for sending the shots and allowing me to use those as well. I very much appreciate it. If you made it this long, remember that you can ask your own questions by mailing me at questions@martinbaileyphotography.com or via any other way of contacting me via the social media networks, etc., or using the contact forms from the website. Thanks once again to our sponsors, WebSpy. To find out more about WebSpy products, visit the webspy.com/MBP website and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on all purchases. I'll be back next week with another Martin Bailey Photography podcast, but in the meantime, you just have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.